that's a demand that we ought to advise them that we do not intend to sign a contract in 1967, accepting as the automobile industry is prepared to pay the same wage to a worker doing the same job for the same corporation, making the same automobile for the same market on both sides of the U.S. and Canadian borders. Because we're going to wipe out the wage differential between the Canadian and U.S. membership of our union in 1967. Now, there will be many other demands, but I would hope that we would always keep in mind that the UAW is not just about another nickel in our pay envelopes. The UAW was born primarily out of a struggle against inhuman exploitation and speed up, and we need always to maintain our maximum militancy and eternal vigilance in guarding our membership against the attempts of the corporations to impose upon our workers unfair work standards and unacceptable working conditions. If you will look at the record of 1947, we spent $47 million in our strike funds. Most of that money was spent supporting local unions over local demands that related primarily to working conditions. And I say, let this great union of ours never forget that what you take home in your pay envelope is important, but of equal, if not greater importance, is what does our union do in the shop every day of the week to protect the interest of our workers on the line and on the workplace. Let us never forget that. And let us let General Motors and all the other great corporations know, yes, they are the largest and most powerful corporations in the world. But we need to remind them always that no matter how big they are or how powerful, none of them will be ever be too big that if they deny us our measure of justice, that they will never be too big to be taken on in the struggle for justice. Because General Motors sometimes thinks maybe that our union is equal to the smaller companies, but is not equal to General Motors. And I say that history will always show that when the chips are down and when we fail to get that measure of justice to which we are entitled without a strike struggle, we are prepared to use that ultimate weapon of free men even against the General Motors Corporation when we must. Now in 1967, we need to give careful and special attention to the parts industry and the small plants. They have many difficult problems that command our attention. We need to give special attention to problems in skilled trades and the office and technical fields. And then in 1968, we need to give special attention to the problems of the aerospace workers. Now, when we talk about our demands, when the labor movement talks about getting a fair share of the wealth that our labor creates, of getting equity out of the fruits of our developing technology, the great captains of industry, and too often the editorial writers always raise the question of inflation. And they say that if labor asks for more, then the prices will go up. And I want to set the record very clear. Your union historically has taken the position and followed the policy that we want our wage increases and our improved fringe benefits not out of the pockets of the American consumers through higher prices. We want those greater benefits out of the increased productivity of our developing technology, we believe that we can have full employment and full production only as we learn to share the fruits of our developing technology between workers and stockholders and consumers so that they can all share. But the problem in America has been that in almost every situation, the worker and the consumer have been shortchanged. We have said repeatedly that we want to base our collective bargaining decisions upon economic facts and not upon economic power. And we have taken that position because the facts are on our side and we can defend what we do based upon economic facts. If you will look at what has happened to wages and profits of all of American industry from the period of 1960 through 1965, wages, salary, including fringe benefits, went up in that period 33%. What happened to profits? This is the profits of all manufacturing industries. Profits after taxes went up 67%, more than twice as fast as the increase in wages and salaries and fringe benefits. And yet they would have us believe that it is the workers demanding higher wages that is responsible for the creation of inflationary pressures in the American and the Canadian economies. Look at the automobile industry, and you'll see what's been happening since we are using the fantastic tools of automation, the tools of science and technology. In 1947, just listen to these figures, and then you know what's happening in industry after industry throughout the American economy. In 1947, there were 626,400 workers in the basic automobile and truck industries. Those 626,000 workers produced 4,792,800 cars and trucks in 1947. In 1965, there were 667,700 workers, and they produced 11,114,100 cars and trucks. So put very simply, an increase of 6.6% in the number of workers made possible an increase of 131.9% production. 41,000 more workers turned out more than 6 million more automobiles and trucks. Now that's the fantastic economics that we're talking about. That's where the higher wages that we're going to get and the improved pensions and the guaranteed annual salary and higher vacations and all of the other things that make for the good life, that's where it's going to come from. Not out of the pockets of the American consumers. But the problem is that we are shortchanged as wage earners and the consumer is shortchanged because the corporations are getting a disproportionate share of the fruits of that developing technology. Just look at General Motors. We used to talk about a $1 billion corporation. You know what we meant? We meant a corporation that did $1 billion worth of business. Now we have the General Motors Corporation making $4,092,000,000 profit in 1 year. Now that's so much that you kid yourself into believing that you comprehend it. So I've broken it down into simpler terms. The General Motors Corporation, for every day in 65, including Sundays and Saturdays and holidays, for every day in 1965, General Motors made $11,210,000 per day. Not bad. You know, the General Motors Corporation has never really appreciated the great humanitarian service the UAW performs for them. Because if we did not periodically relieve them of the burden of carrying around all those heavy money bags, it would literally break their backs. And so I can say to them for you that in 1967, we intend to give them a lot of relief on that problem. Now, just so our Ford brothers don't feel slighted, the Ford Motor Company is not exactly living in poverty. The Ford Motor Company in 1965 made a profit before taxes of $1,305,000,000, the highest in the history of that company. And the Chrysler Corporation, they broke records, and they made $448 million. And the ag implement industry, they broke records. The Caterpillar Company, for example, they made a profit of $288 million. And they made a return on their investment of 29% after taxes, 1% better than General Motors made. And the aerospace industry, they're obviously not qualifying to be recipients of the government's anti-poverty program. Their profits in 1964 were $395 million, and in 65 they went up 32%. Up to $5,524,000,000. But the problem is, and it's not a new problem, it's a problem that we have faced from the very beginning, 30 years ago. The corporation executives have always lived by double economic and moral standards. They've always had one set of standards for the worker and another set of standards for themselves. And when you look at the salaries and the bonuses that the automobile industry is giving its top executives, you can understand how badly we are being shortchanged. The chairman of the board of the General Motors Corporation, he got in salary and bonus in 1965 a sum 99 times as great as the average General Motors worker, not counting his stock option bonus. The chairman of the Ford Motor Company, his salary and bonus was 78 times as great as the average wage for a Ford worker, not counting $4 million that he got in dividends. And the chairman of the Chrysler Corporation, his salary and bonus, not counting his stock option, was 65 times as great as the average wage and salary of a Chrysler worker. And I say to you that we ought to say to them that nobody in America is 99 times better than another worker working for the same corporations. Now we meet at a very time when our country is much concerned with the inflationary problem, because in 1965, the cost of living went up 2.8%. This was the highest increase since the Korean War. And in the last 10 days, there have been serious cutbacks in the automobile industry, and thousands of workers are on short work week. And people are concerned. And I believe that this is a time when the automobile industry has a historic opportunity to demonstrate a high sense of public responsibility and economic statesmanship. The auto industry, out of these fantastic profits, ought to be able now to cut prices from $100 to $200 per car and truck. And if the automobile industry would do that, this would represent a tremendous constructive contribution in counteracting the forces of inflation. Secondly, it would stimulate the sale of cars, and we could ensure continued high levels of employment and production. And thirdly, the industry could do this and still have a higher earning than most American industries, even after they cut the price from $100 to $200. I'd suggest you not hold your breath, however, until they cut prices, because we have been beating these drums for years, urging the industry to cut prices, but they have been unwilling to do it. And this is the source of the basic problems of imbalance in our economy. Why have we had unemployment? Why have we had recessions? It's because while we have the tools of economic abundance, we have not learned how to create a dynamic relationship between greater productive power and greater purchasing power in the hands of people. And because the people have always had too little purchasing power, they have never been able to create the kind of active demand necessary to bring our productive potential into full production. And until we get a more equitable distribution of our national income, we will never solve the basic problem of unemployment and avoid periodic recessions in the American and Canadian economies. When you look at the fact, and this is one of those stubborn economic facts that we must deal with, 5% of the families at the top of the economic pyramid had a larger income than 40% of the families at the bottom. Now the 5% have more than they need, and the 40% have too little. And the fight in which we are engaged is a fight to help the many with too little to get enough. Because until the many with too little get enough, we will not have created the dynamic forces of economic balance in the American economy. I think it is a national disgrace and a tragic shame that America, the richest country in the world, a country that this year will have a gross national product of $730 billion, still tolerates human poverty in the midst of plenty. 30 million Americans, as we meet here, are living in poverty. They are the old and the sick. They are the young and the disabled. They are the unemployed and the partially unemployed. They are the have-not peoples of America. They have been denied and deprived. They have been dispossessed and disadvantaged. And if their skins are dark, they are discriminated against. Now, poverty in America is the most immoral kind of poverty any place in the world. There is much poverty in this world of ours. More than 100 billion people have an income of less than $100 per year. But their poverty is the poverty of economic scarcity. They are poor because they have too little. But we have poverty in the midst of economic abundance. And that's why I believe that poverty in America is more destructive of human values than is poverty in any other part of the world. Because the poor in America are not only robbed economically, they are robbed spiritually, because they are denied any sense of belonging, any sense of participating, because they are shut out in our society and denied any sense of human dignity or any sense of human worth. And these are the kind of things that we've got to deal with. Now, tomorrow we're going to put some men in space. And I'm all for the space program. I would like to see America put a man on the moon. But I believe that our place in history will be much better protected if America can be the first nation in the world that abolished human poverty, even if we aren't the first nation in the world to put a man on the moon. Because I believe that America's credentials are not in order so long as we tolerate human poverty in the midst of our great abundance. Now, we've invited President Johnson to come to our convention. We don't know for certain whether he will be here. We are hopeful he will join us in our celebration rally. on Friday evening, but we have told the President that we have joined with him in the building of the Great Society. But what is the Great Society? Is the Great Society a society that has great technological achievements, that has great material wealth, that has a massive production of new gadgets? No, a great society is more than that. A great society is a society that knows how to translate material wealth into human values, that knows how to ensure that technological progress will mean human progress and human happiness and the opportunities of human fulfillment. And while we have made great technological progress, there is much work to be done to equate this technological progress to the needs of the human family in this great and wonderful land of ours. As we said many times before, this is the first time in human history that the tools of production are adequate to solve the needs of the human family. We know how to produce food and clothing and shelter and all the other things that we need. The real question is, will we use these tools with a sense of social responsibility, with a sense of moral purpose in terms of the needs of people? The real challenge is, can we demonstrate the social discipline needed to relate our technological progress to the needs of all the people? If we look at the unfinished agenda of U.S. and Canadian democracy, you will find that the list is long. And what we need to do is to work out a list of priorities, put first things first, and then commit ourselves and our resources to the practical fulfillment of those priorities. And I should like briefly to touch upon those things that we are working at in the UAW. First, we want a total war against human poverty. We want to wipe out every ugly form of human poverty, and we want to establish in our countries a guaranteed minimum annual family income for every family. Secondly, because we in the labor movement have been in the front ranks of the struggle for education, because we believe that every child is made in the image of God, every child ought to have the kind of educational opportunity to fulfill its maximum growth and development. And yet we all know that there are tragic deficits in the quality of education in both the United States and Canada. We need to expand our social security system so that every aged citizen can share an increased measure of security and dignity when he is too old to work but too young to die. We need to work harder with a great national coalition of conscience of the church groups and the civil rights groups in completing the civil rights revolution so that we can fulfill the promise of that revolution, so that we can give meaning and substance to the concepts of equal rights and equal opportunities for all of our citizens. We need to provide a decent job at a decent wage in a full employment, full production economy for every worker able and willing to work. And we need to remove the economic obstacles to good health. Let me just point out, here we are living in the richest nation in the world, and yet last year 40,000 newborn babies died because of lack of adequate medical care. We, although we are the richest nation in the world, rank 14th in terms of infant mortality. We need to wipe out the slums and the social cesspools and rebuild our cities and make them worthy of living places for free men. We need to work on the problem of cleaning up the air we breathe and getting the pollution out of our streams and our lakes and conserving and beautifying our natural resources for future generations. Now, these are the things to which the UAW is committed to work for in the years ahead. It will take new concepts and new ideas to bring these new things to practical fulfillment. We believe that we need to develop in America a concept of national democratic planning, because we do not believe that you can achieve full employment and full production by blind reliance upon the forces of the marketplace. We believe that just as General Motors is able to plan for profits, we ought to have public planning for people. And finally, 1966 is a year of challenge to the UAW and the labor movement on the political front. We in the UAW are in politics not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of necessity, because we have learned the hard way that there is an inseparable relationship between the breadbox and the ballot box. We learned in 1958, 1957, 1956, that the SUB benefits that we were able to win at the bargaining table in 1955 were taken away from us in the legislative halls in Ohio and Indiana, where the state legislatures passed legislation blocking the right of workers to get SUB benefits, even though the contract provided for such benefits and the money was in the funds to pay them. And therefore, we realized that electing the right congressmen, electing the right legislators in the state government is just as important to the economic well-being of a worker and his family as the person that you elect to represent you at the bargaining table. Now, in 64, we did a good job, and we won a tremendous victory at the polls. And we laid the groundwork with the most liberal Congress in history for the Great Society. And they enacted Medicare and aid to education and civil rights, anti-poverty legislation and housing and many other things. But that job is only partially completed. And the Congress that we elect in 66 will go back in the beginning of 67 to complete that task. And so we have a tremendous task to perform. And let us all work at that task so that in 1966 we can elect a Congress that will carry on the Great Society legislative program. And then finally, I would like to say that you will have before you a resolution dealing with the international situation. We live in a very troubled world. All of us are deeply concerned about the tragic situation in Vietnam. And each of us, I'm sure, prays that somehow we'll be able to get that dispute from the battlefield to the conference table, because there is no military solution to a problem which is essentially social and economic and political in character. We are in deep trouble in the world because the world is locked in an arms race, and every nation is a prisoner of that arms race, large and small, weak and strong nations alike. And the nations of the world are spending this year $200 billion for armaments. They are all searching for national security. But when they will have spent these $200 billion, we will all be more insecure, because we will have made more destructive weapons of overkill. What we need to do is to find a way in the world to shift the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race that no one can win to a positive contest between our competing social systems, to see which social system can best harness man's creative genius in the field of science and technology and gear the productive power of the 20th century technological revolution, not in producing the weapons of war and destruction, but making the good things of life for people. The only war that man can win is the only war that man wants to wage. It's the war against poverty, the war against ignorance and disease, the war against social injustice. This is the war the people of the world want to wage, and I believe that our system of freedom is equal to waging that kind of a war in competition with the other system that challenges us. But we, because we live in the strongest of the free nations of the world, we must provide the leadership in shifting this contest from the negative arms race to a positive contest of waging the peace. And our union and the free world labor movement of the world of which we are a part, we must play an increasing role in these great issues, both at home and in the world. And I am confident that this convention, through the process of democratic discussion and debate, will formulate programs and policies, will provide us with new tools to move forward. And as we celebrate this 30th year of our great achievements, let us all rededicate ourselves to the kind of social idealism, to the spirit of solidarity and human brotherhood, which was the cement out of which this union grew and developed 30 years ago. And if we build our solidarity more firmly, we can leave here, I am convinced, prepared to make a greater and greater contribution. And we extend to our trade union colleagues, whom we will have the privilege of introducing to you tomorrow, from all countries of the world, we extend to them our hand of friendship and solidarity, and we pledge to work with them and with men and women of goodwill all over the world, because I believe if we work together, that together we can build a rational and responsible world community, and together we can harness the rising star of science and technology and relate it to the rewarding purposes of peace. And together we can translate the 20th century technological revolution into the 20th century revolution of human fulfillment. Thank you, and God bless all of you.